Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Good morning and welcome. From Mayor of Richmond to Lieutenant Governor and then Governor of Virginia, now Mr. Kane is going to Washington. Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at UVA. Thanks for joining us. 1 month and 1 day ago, Tim Kaine defeated George Allen in the race to fill Jim Webb's seat in the U.S. Senate. And his victory speech that night was noteworthy in that it was a little bilingual and had some breaking news in it as well.
Thank you all so much. It is a great night to be a Virginian. Somos Virginianos todos. In 2008. Thank you guys. What a great crowd. You know, in 2008, Virginia made some wonderful history by sending a fiscally responsible former governor to the United States Senate and helping to put Barack Obama in the White House. Well, the night is still young, but thanks to you, we're already halfway there to doing it again tonight. Actually, we're more than halfway there. NBC just called the presidential race.
And I'm pleased to welcome to Virginia Conversations the Commonwealth's new Senator-elect, Tim Kaine. Welcome.
Hey, Bob. You sure could hear I didn't have much of a voice left on November 6th as I'm listening to that tape.
It was an interesting evening, and it ended earlier than many had expected that it might. Governor, if you were still governor, would you want to privatize the Port of Virginia for a shot of cash to put into state transportation coffers?
No, to answer your question directly, no. You ought to maximize the value of the port for Virginia, and you ought to fund transportation, but you shouldn't use the port as a cash cow to fund transportation. So I'm open to any proposal with the port that enables the port to be all that it can be. I mean, the Port of Virginia is one of the two most important economic development assets we have. That port and Dulles Airport, these two great international hubs and gateways. We ought to do the right thing by the port to enable it to continue to be strong, and we ought to do the right thing to fund our transportation network. If there's some connection there, that's fine, but we shouldn't be looking at the port as kind of a cash cow to help us fund transportation.
So privatizing through a lease of 40 or 99 years is not the thing that you would look at?
I think you need to completely sever what's right for the port with transportation. I'm okay with exploring private management of the port. I would not want to privatize the asset. I think that would be a very bad deal. It's great that Virginia owns that port. It's great that Virginia leaders with foresight, like my father-in-law, Linwood Holton, when he was governor, worked to unify the port operations. You know, it was competing ports in Newport News, Portsmouth, and Norfolk. Now they're unified. And if private management is the best way to make that port all it can be, that's great. But we shouldn't be looking at the port primarily as, can we get money out of this to fund transportation infrastructure? Make the port all it can be. That's the greatest thing we could do for the future of the Virginia economy. Fund transportation. If there's some way to combine the two, that's great. But I worry a little bit that we're letting our desire to find transportation funding dictate what we do with the port. And I'm not sure that's the best way to approach the long-term value of that port operation.
Well, what's controversial in Hampton Roads right now is a long-term lease to APM, a Danish firm, which is one of the competitors using this unified port now. If they managed the entire port, they would be managing their competitors' interests as well as their own, wouldn't they?
Well, and this is something I got to say as a participant in a 19-month statewide race for the Senate. I haven't paid as much attention to the details of the state's negotiation with APM as maybe I now will now that the campaign is over. But again, I'm just going to kind of stick with the conceptual point. I'm not averse to private management. If that's going to help the port be all it can be, you do have to explore, you know, is the fact that it would be managed by a competitor, is that in the best interests of the of this long-term operation? If they operate other ports up and down the East Coast, you know, would they maximize what happens at Virginia, or would they put traffic into other ports? What Virginia should do is maximize the value of that port operation to Virginia, because, again, I think economic success in the 21st century is about two things. It's about winning the talent race, and it's about global connections. Our global connections through that port and through Dulles Airport are two of the best things we have. Any governor would love to have an international port. Any governor would love to have an international airport. Very few states have both. We have both, and that means that what drives the port decision should not be, maybe we can get some money for roads out of this. No. What should drive the port decisions is, how can we continue to attract more and more freight to Virginia and give Virginia businesses greater ease in exporting their products around the world?
What should Virginia be doing offshore for energy production and exploration?
I think the energy plan that I signed working together with legislators in 2007, it was the first energy plan we had put in place, said we ought to be open to offshore exploration and production. And that would include both, I think, natural gas and wind, very, very promising opportunities. I think
not oil?
I'm a little bit nervous about being able to do it and do it safely. I think, you know, I was very struck by the BP spill, and I would never want to harm a regional economy like the Hampton Roads economy that leans on twin pillars of tourism and military installations by having some kind of an oil spill or cataclysm there. That could be devastating to the second largest region in Virginia, and a lot of national assets are there. But I do think exploring and producing energy offshore is a good idea. I have expressed support for a bill that's currently pending that Senators Webb and Warner have promoted that would suggest that you could do offshore energy production off the coast of Virginia if Virginia got a share of the revenues.
How much of the revenue would come to Virginia under the Warner Webb proposal?
You know,
is that realistic? Is the federal government about to share?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the realism question, I'll find out when I get there. I mean, that is obviously a federal policy that would be important. I believe the Webb-Warner bill would put the Virginia revenues at about 40%, but I'm doing that from memory, and I didn't prep that to come in.
Well, that would be a significant shot in the state's revenues.
It would, and you could use that. You know, you could use that for transportation. You could use it for open space conservation. I think that would be good. But the idea of doing it in Virginia, we get no share in it. I don't think that makes any sense. And in addition, while we're talking offshore, you know, I do think recent announcements, the McDonnell administration working together with the White House, have talked about offshore wind opportunities, leasing plots of land for offshore wind development. I think that makes tremendous sense. I think that, you know, wind energy is clearly one of the energies of the future, but more than a third of the power put onto the American power grid since 2007 has been wind power. This is not just some untried technology anymore. It's producing significant power around the country, and I think Virginia needs to play a role in that.
Since 1977, Virginians have elected a governor of the opposite party to the person who was just elected to the White House the year after the presidential election. What do you see as the chances this far out for Governor Ken Cuccinelli?
Well, I think there's been some polling that would suggest that a race between Ken Cuccinelli and Terry McAuliffe, the sole Democrat who is running for governor now, that the polling on that would suggest that the race would be close. The polls I've seen suggest that Terry would have a slight edge, but it would all be in the realm of it's very close. And a whole lot of voters either haven't made up their mind, or they have a soft preference and they haven't, you know, pinned down on their ultimate vote. I think that the governor's race in 2013 in Virginia is going to be real close. I think you've got two very energetic candidates who are going to have very energetic followings. They're going to have their own followings, and they're also going to inspire those on the other side to work real hard against them. So it's going to be a close race. I'm going to work very, very hard for our own party's nominee. I was a little bit, you know, I guess kind of discouraged at Bill Bowling's announcement last week, because I've known Bill for a long time, the current lieutenant governor. I was elected to city council the year after he was elected to the Hanover Board of Supervisors. Bill and I don't agree on everything, but I've always gotten along very well with him. Fine person. And I've always viewed Bill as somebody coming out of the pro-business, kind of pro-governance part of the Republican Party. And when somebody in that wing looks at the nominating process and says, well, there's not really any place in this for me, I think that's a concern.
There will be a lot of money, a lot of outside money, a lot of money perhaps coming into Virginia the way it did in your race.
Yep.
And in the Obama race for the White House. With the idea of attacking the other side, defining mm-hmm. defining the other guy before he
yep.
is able to define himself for the electorate, is there any change you would propose for the kind of money that is coming into politics today that allows
Absolutely.
Some campaigns to have 300% of their funding basically off campaign books?
Yeah, the real tragedy of the post Citizens United campaigns, the 2010 and 2012 cycles, is that we're moving to a secret money system. I mean, the fundamental campaign reform after Watergate, you know, Watergate wasn't just a break-in. It was also cash and grocery sacks being passed around. And every state and the federal government then passed campaign laws that promoted transparency. The public ought to have a right to know who's funding campaigns. Well, Citizens United and other quirks in the election laws have allowed these third-party groups, 501c4 organizations, to basically advertise without disclosing their donors. If you don't have to disclose your donors, the research has already demonstrated there's a higher likelihood that the ad will be false, because there's no shame in being associated with a lie if nobody can associate you with a lie. So these third-party ads have a high likelihood of being false. They're very negative. They're not funded by Virginians usually. It's people outside the state. What I would do and what I will do as soon as I go to the Senate is I'll support two principles. First, no secret money. I just think there ought to be a no secret money rule. If you're giving money to a candidate or a committee or a state party or a local party, these money should all have to be disclosed.
That used to be the Virginia way.
That is. The Virginia system that's often touted is we don't have campaign limits, but we require transparency and contributions. But we need to broaden the definition of what transparency is to also encompass donations to these groups that are running these advocacy ads and trying to hide their donors. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, was one of the biggest advertisers against me in the last cycle. And they proudly said, no, we're not going to disclose our donors, and we're happy we don't have to. Well, I think they may be happy, but the American public and the Virginia public deserves to know who the donors are. So that's the first thing I do, a very straightforward and all-encompassing no-secret money rule. The second thing we ought to explore is if the Supreme Court has said corporations can give, and the Supreme Court is not likely to change that precedent anytime soon, the Supreme Court did – I think the Supreme Court would uphold a rule that said a corporation can only give if there was a shareholder vote. And what would, you know, if you did that, you'd probably have to have the same requirement for all organizations, unions or other organizations. There would have to be some ratification by members or shareholders. If you had that kind of a requirement, that would also curb the size and amount of these contributions. So you know, those two principles, no secret money and for an organization to give, it's got to be approved by members or shareholders or principles I would support that I think could kind of curb some of the negative influence.
Some Virginians had to wait 3 hours or longer in line to vote last month. What should be done to protect the right to vote from this type of quite discouraging wait in line?
My sense is that the reason for the wait in most circumstances was an inadequate number of voting machines. And, you know, one of the things, Bob, that a lot of folks don't understand is that, you know, it's kind of a quirk of Virginia law, but most states do it this way. The state laws affect how voting takes place, dictate how voting takes place, but we rely on local governments. It's local governments and local budgets.
They have to pay for the machines and the people.
Yeah, they got to pay for the machines and people. And so if they don't have enough machines, and often, hey, look, it's been a tough revenue time the last years. If they don't have enough machines, and then you have lines that are too long. So I think what the General Assembly should do, and more broadly, we can look at this at the federal level, is have some standards for the number of machines per registered voters. There was absolutely no reason that there should have been three-hour lines in Virginia, because we knew what was coming. We had had long lines, and we knew what the turnout was in 2008. And based on that, you know, there should have been – it was easy to plan to prepare for a similar presidential turnout in 2012. We know there's going to be a similar presidential turnout in 2016. You know, presidential years have higher turnout than other years, but we need to probably go into the state laws that set the minimum requirements for the number of voting machines per voter, per registered voter in jurisdiction.
Would money come with that requirement?
I think that if we're serious about it and the integrity the integrity of the election reflects on the whole state. If you've got four or five jurisdictions where there are three-hour lines, it's not just the jurisdiction that gets the black eye. The state gets the black eye. So I think having meaningful state support for that is something that would be a very legitimate way to spend state dollars.
One of the unfinished pieces of business being left behind by Senator Jim Webb, the man whose seat you take next month, is prison reform, or how best to handle the huge and very expensive nonviolent inmate population that crowds our prisons. What are the chances are you can pick up and carry on that work, and do you intend to?
I'd like to, Bob. I don't know what committees I'm going to be on yet, so some of that work is probably most naturally done within the framework of the Judiciary Committee. But, as you know, when I was governor, I was very passionate about the restoration of voting rights, and so I restored voting rights to about 4,500 individuals who had their voting rights permanently taken away because of felony convictions, largely nonviolent felonies, people who had then lived exemplary lives since they had been released from prison, and I restored their voting rights. I'm troubled by both the incarceration numbers in this country that are so out of whack with other countries, and as Jim Webb used to always say, you look at the number of people incarcerated in the United States compared to other countries, and you reach one of two conclusions. Either we're worse people than others, or we're making some public policy mistakes. And I think there are some public policy choices that have been made over the last couple of decades that have incarcerated too many people and have done it in a way that are just that just is fiscally very, very irresponsible. So trying to find ways to bring down some of those incarceration costs and move us more into, the right area, especially with respect to nonviolent crimes, more into, norms of what other nations do in incarceration, I think that makes sense.
Do you have an inkling yet of what committees you might be assigned to, and which ones have you sort of put in your best requests for?
I'll tell you what I've asked for, but what I hear is, you're not going to get everything you asked for, and you're going to get some things that weren't on your list.
You're going to learn about the seniority system.
You will learn about the seniority system. The four committees that I asked for sort of in order were Armed Services. I really want to pick up Jim's Armed Services portfolio, and it's very important for a Virginian to be on Armed Services. I really loved the opportunity as governor to be Commander-in-Chief of the Virginia Guard, which in peacetime is normally not that time-consuming kind of a part of the job. But when you're in the middle of two wars, I went to Iraq and Afghanistan. I spent time at homecomings and deployments and funerals and wakes and spent time with military families. And it's the kind of thing that I'd really like to do. So that would be Committee 1.
Let's come back and talk about the other three committees after we take a short break. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. We'll continue with Senator-elect Tim Kaine in a moment. And we invite you to join the conversation by calling our toll-free number. That's 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. Stay with us. We'll be right back in 1 minute.
WVTF Radio IQ End of Year Campaign is our last chance to meet the new year without the binding chains of financial constraint. Your tax-deductible contribution of $35, $50, $75, or whatever amount you can give will ensure that we enter 2013 in strong financial shape, and that means stronger programming will remain on WVTF Radio IQ in the new year. To pitch in with your end-of-year contribution, go to WVTF.org and click the Pledge Now button on our homepage. Support comes from the Fralin Museum of Art at UVA, featuring Jean Elion, Reality and Abstraction. Details at virginia.edu/artmuseum. Cloudy through the day today, not as cool, with highs around 58. Mostly cloudy tonight with isolated showers. Lows approaching 45.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Today we're pleased to have with us Virginia's new freshman U.S. Senator Tim Kaine. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. You can join the conversation by calling our toll-free number. That's 866-611-NEWS, 866-611-6397. Governor Kaine, we were talking about the committees that
yep.
you have requested. You don't know yet which ones you're going to get, but after Armed Services, what did you ask for?
Next, health and education. You know, I really believe if you win the talent race, you win the economic race, and education issues I'm very passionate about. I'm pre-K to post-grad. I'd love to be on that committee. Third, foreign relations. I'm very passionate about the role of America as a global leader. You know, when we balance military strength, economic strength, diplomatic strength, and the strength of our moral example, we play a really important role in the world. And so I'd love to be on foreign relations. I have a particular fascination with the Americas because of my time as a missionary in Honduras. And interestingly enough, Bob, with 100 senators, since Chris Dodd retired a couple of years ago, there's not a real Americas person. There are a couple of senators who are very passionate about the U.S.-Cuba relationship, but in terms of focusing on, you know, the Yukon to Patagonia, there's not somebody who is really making the Americas their area of expertise. And I think that there are huge opportunities for us in the Americas, but also some missed opportunities in the last decade, and I'd love to work on that. And then the last committee that I put in for is a committee called Small Business and Entrepreneurship. I grew up in a household where my dad ran an ironworking and welding shop. It's a and you know, small businesses are the job creators, and often when I hear policymakers on TV talk about the job creators, it's like they're talking about ExxonMobil or something. But no, the job creators are the small businesses and the entrepreneurs, and I would really love to be on that committee too. So I put in for four. What I've heard is that probably most senators will get three committee assignments. And I've definitely heard you'll get some of what you asked for, and you won't get some.
And some of what you didn't ask for.
And then you'll get a committee that's like, what? Why am I not? You know, so but I'm anxious to dig in and, you know, do good work.
Well, good. Let's go to our callers. Our first caller is Joyce from Roanoke. Joyce, welcome to Virginia Conversations. You're on with Senator-elect Tim Kaine.
Yes, Tim. I don't
hey,
know
Joyce.
If you will remember this, but many years ago before I retired, you and Mark were at Salem High School. And you spent about an hour and a half in my journalism room where we were doing yearbooks.
I do remember this.
I'm on the computer, and you had done newspaper when you were in school, and you
absolutely
had waxing down the spreads. first of all, I want to give you a big thank you because you are so positive about everything. And I don't know if you understand what it's like out here in the real world. To hear so much negativity,
yeah.
But when you hear your name, you think of something positive, and the world appreciates that. Secondly,
well, Joyce, oh yeah, please, second.
Secondly, I'd like to ask if there's anything that the public could do, your supporters could do, to sway those committee assignments. We would love to see you on education.
Well, you know, I think that the assignments are made by the Senate leadership, and I have not asked anybody to weigh in with the Senate leadership, so I'm not really sure. I saw, you know, some senators, senator-elects doing petition drives to get on this or that committee.
Mm-hmm.
I think just, you know, prayers and good wishes is probably at this point. You know, I've made my case, and, you know, I feel good about it. Joyce, I will say one of the challenges a little bit with the committee assignments is some of the assignments are based not only on seniority, but how many vacancies there are on some of the committees. So some committees, just because of the, you know, who are the 12 members that leave, that have a lot of vacancies, and some only have a few.
Okay.
But I really appreciate your willingness to help. And on the positive thing, I am a positive person by nature, but I also feel like, you know, we more often bend events to the ends that we wish to bend them to if we keep positive attitude.
Sure.
You know, my mom used to always tell me, if you want to be right, be a pessimist. But if you want to do right, be an optimist. And I'd rather do right than be right. So that's why I'm an optimist.
I love it. Now, I have one more question.
Yeah.
I used to travel my journalism students for 15 years up to Columbia University for workshops and then also to teach them about the city. Now that I've retired, a bunch of my old fogey friends want to go through the White House and take a tour. How do I do that?
I will. Good point. I will swear in on the 3rd of January. Now, assuming you're talking about not in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, no. It'll be in April.
Okay. I swear in on the 3rd of January. You can call the Senate switchboard and get connected to my office, and I'd love to help make sure that you guys get a White House tour.
Good deal. I told them I could get through to you. Thank you so much, Joyce. And thank you for what you're going to do for us.
You bet, Joyce. And I'll look forward to talking after January and get that White House tour set up.
Thanks,
Joyce.
I'll
look forward to seeing you sworn in.
Thanks.
Thanks for your call and your questions. A senator from Nevada apparently has a lot to do with which committees you might end up on.
That is very true.
Now, you and Harry Reid worked together when you were at the DNC, so at least you...
Yeah. Harry, actually, I met Harry when he asked me to... was one of the people that asked me to do the State of the Union response in 2006. Worked with him when I was governor, worked with him when I was party chair. We have a good relationship. He and the Senate leadership will make those committee assignment picks, and I've made my case to them and keeping my fingers crossed.
Senator-elect Tim Kaine is my guest on Virginia Conversations. Give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Our next caller is Fred from Richmond. Fred, welcome to Virginia Conversations. You're on with the governor, the senator-elect.
Hi, Governor Kaine.
I'm curious, Fred,
to know what your view is of the failure recently of the Senate to vote to ratify the UN Treaty on Rights of People with Disabilities and what this portends for the future.
Well, Fred, I was very disappointed in this vote. I guess it was two days ago that the Senate could not get the two-thirds vote necessary to ratify this UN treaty on rights of folks with disabilities. Again, just, you know, quick for voters or for listeners, the ratification of treaties in the Senate requires a two-thirds vote. So it's the highest vote requirement there is. I think the treaty ratification got about 61 votes. It fell 5 votes short. But it was a very, very basic and common sense treaty that I strongly supported. During the campaign, I was asked about it and indicated that I would certainly vote for ratification of the treaty. Both Presidents Bush, President Bush 41 and President Bush 43, weighed in favor of it. And in one of the most poignant things I've seen in the Senate in recent memory, Bob Dole, who was one of the key architects and sponsors of the Americans with Disabilities Act, when it passed the Senate in the late 1980s, Senator Dole, came to the floor of the Senate, now in a wheelchair, to impress upon the members how important this was. And the fact that the treaty failed is an indication to me of we got a lot of work to do in the Senate. We got a lot of work to do in Washington. I think in hearing the rationale of those who voted against it, I think the rationales were unpersuasive, and I will certainly be a vote for ratification and try to encourage others to hopefully rethink their positions. There are 12 newcomers coming into the Senate. Maybe that can help. But I think we should consider it a setback, but not the end of the struggle.
Thank you, Fred. Thanks for your call.
I appreciate it. Good luck.
Thank you.
What can you do to help bring back a level of bipartisanship to the U.S. Senate that seems to have been lost quite significantly in the last several years?
Bob, there's nothing. You got to be humble about what you can do as one person, but it will just be a succession of